Good evening. It is so very good to see everyone that has chosen to come out this evening. That your desire to come together and to sing songs of praise to God, to offer up worship in His name, is to be commended. As we've been studying over the past couple of weeks, we've been looking at this period of time leading up to the period of silence between the Old Testament and the New Testament. And it's always kind of amazed me how, without any planning sometimes, things just really just work out quite wonderfully. You don't even think about these things until they're happening. And if you notice in our reading there in Hosea, there in chapter 5, as Brother Harold was reading there, God is saying through Hosea, "I will be like a lion to Ephraim, like a young lion to the house of Judah. I will tear to pieces and go away. I will carry away, and there will be none to deliver. I will go away and return to my place until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face." Now, this is a prophecy that was made before the fall of Israel. As we've been noting in our lessons, the nations divided into the nation of Israel and Judah, and the nation of Israel fell into the Assyrian bondage. And this is something that Hosea was recording before the Assyrians came and took the Israelites, or as they're called here in the book of Hosea, took those of Ephraim into captivity. And so God is foretelling these things are going to happen. They're going to be carried away. And then as we were singing the song, number 361, "In His time, you do just what you say in your time." As we look throughout these things, as we look at the history that is being provided for us, as we look at the things that happened with the Babylonian Empire, the Medes and the Persians, as we go on into the Grecians and the Romans, we see that each thing was according to the time of God. God raised up, God dropped each nation in time according to His plan. You remember, we looked there in the book of Daniel as we were looking at the kingship of Nebuchadnezzar. And we looked at that image that he received, that Daniel, through the power of God, interpreted, saying, "You, O king, is the head of gold. You're the king of gold." And then he said, "In the arms and belly, that's going to be the next kingdom that's going to come along, the Medes and the Persians. And in the next kingdom, the thighs, that's going to be another kingdom, the Greeks. And then finally, there's going to be a fourth kingdom." He's showing the timeline of God, that God is going to set these things up. And so it just never ceases to amaze me how, with no planning, I didn't say anything to Nathan. He just picked out the songs that he likes. And that was just really, I think, a perfect lead-in song to looking at the things that we're looking at. Because we want to keep in mind, God had these plans. As we come to the close of the lesson this evening, we're going to close out the Old Testament. But as we look, as we continue the lessons, looking at the remainder portion of the Medes and the Persians, and we look at the Grecians and the Romans, we can see that God is at work in all of these things. That God's plan is being carried out. Now once again, after the Assyrian Empire, we had the Babylonian Empire that came in and took over the Assyrians. And also took over that tiny little nation of Judah that we remember seeing there, that little speck there amongst the Assyrian Empire. They were carried off into Babylonian bondage. They were going to remain there for 70 years, and we read in the Scriptures that the reason they were going to be there for 70 years is God wanted the land to have its Sabbath. They had not been keeping the Sabbath year as they should, and so He made sure that that land was going to have 70 years of Sabbath, where the land would have rest because of all the evil that had been done. Now, Assyria conquered Israel in 721. The Babylonians conquered Judah around 612 B.C., and finally destroyed Judah there in Jerusalem there around 595 B.C., Now remember, keep that in mind, that the Babylonians destroyed the city of Jerusalem there. I'm sorry, 597 BC, and they've been carried off into captivity. Now, as we noted in our lesson last week, with the close of the rule of Nabonidus and his son Belshazzar, the grandson and great grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Just 6 years after the death of Nebuchadnezzar, they began to rule. And we find where Belshazzar is there in the palace. He's having a party with all the high muckety muck prince friends of his. And there's the writing on the wall. And this is the warning of God saying, "Your time is over. You're going to be passed over to the Medes and the Persians." Now we read of Cyrus. We noted that Cyrus was talked about there in the book of Isaiah, there in a couple of places. Isaiah says, Cyrus will give the decree for the people to return from their captivity. Now this was a long time before they were even taken captive. Cyrus began ruling around 538 BC and ruled for about 8 years, 250 years after Isaiah made that prophecy. As we noted in our lesson last week, we looked at the time of Cyrus and his son Cambyses. Cyrus gave the decree that the Jews could go back to the land of Canaan. They could go back and rebuild the temple and rebuild the city of Jerusalem. And they go back under the direction of Zerubbabel. When Cyrus dies and Cambyses comes in, we noted last week that the people around them stirred up some trouble. Hey, you don't have authority. Who gave you this authority? And they sent and the work on the temple stopped. And we noted that it remained stopped for a good period of time. Now, with the reign of Darius the Great, Smerdis was a usurper of the throne that only remained there for a couple of months until Darius the Great came in and put him to death and took over. And we see where they once again continued on with the work. It had been 16 years since they stopped, and during the reign of Darius, around 516 BC, almost 20 years after it had begun in rebuilding the temple, they were able to complete it. They were able to partake of the Passover feast for the first time in all those years that they were captive. We noted that Darius had this inscription called the Behistun inscription that is there just north of the capital. That inscription gave a key to Babylonian cuneiform, which allows us to read a lot of things that up until that point in time had been impossible for them to figure out. Darius went about increasing the size of his empire, and he increased it beyond the borders of Cyrus, going all the way to India. There, the Indus River, all the way into the edge of Greece, the Aegean Sea, conquering all of that and conquering from Asia, modern Asia, the lower portion of that, all the way down to Ethiopia. Now, with the death of Darius, we have his son Xerxes coming into reign around 486 BC. And he had to spend the beginning of his reign and quelling some revolts. Of course, with any time a new king comes in, what are they going to do? They're going to test the mettle of the king. We find that with the president. We have a number of nations around us that are testing the mettle of our president, trying to see exactly how far they can push him before he'll take action against them. And this is exactly what Xerxes went through. Now, Xerxes, being the son of Darius, he was a little peeved that his father had not been able to conquer the Greeks, and so he went and did what he could to conquer the Greeks, going all the way over to Athens and conquering Athens, conquering the area around there, burning the Acropolis there in Athens. But his navy met defeat there at Samothrace. Now, if you remember that name, that's something we read of in the New Testament, where the Apostle Paul was traveling from Troas over to Philippi, and he spent the night there on the island, of Salamis, not Samothrace, of Salamis. And after that, his army was just cut to pieces by the Greeks, and he was pretty much sent packing back to the palace, nursing his wounds. As he returned home, he then began a building program, trying to continue the things that his father had done. Darius, we noted last week, had begun building roads and trying to make the empire a little bit more travel friendly, encouraging people to go back to their homes and things of that nature. It is this period of time that we have that's between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7. In Ezra chapter 6, we read of Darius, the father of Xerxes. In Ezra chapter 7, we read of Artaxerxes, the son. And it is during this period of time that we read about this wonderful lady that we don't think much about, Esther. Now, there are those that try to say that the Ahasuerus of the book of Esther is Artaxerxes. Some say it's Xerxes. Really, when you look at the timeline and all the events that are going on, it seems to fit best here with Xerxes. Around 484 BC, Ahasuerus, as he is known in the book of Esther, and if you would like to go ahead and turn over there, we'll be looking at some passages there from the book of Esther. Ahasuerus, as he is described, as he is called here in the book of Esther, decided that he wanted to kind of talk to everybody and show everybody just exactly how great of an individual he was. And so he began this series of gatherings where he showed off all of his wealth to all the princes of the land. He invited them all to great feast. He invited them to come to his palace, and they all drank out of the gold and the silver emblems that he had there in the palace. And it was at the end of this. This lasted for about 6 months. Imagine a 6 month party there in the palace. At the end of those 6 months, he closed it all out with a 7 day banquet. And during the 7 day banquet, he decided, all right, I've shown them all the wealth. I've shown them how mighty and how powerful I am. Now it's time to show them how beautiful my wife is. And so he calls to the head eunuch and says, hey, bring Vashti, my wife, out. And let's parade her before these individuals so that they can see not only am I powerful, not only am I rich, but I've also got the most beautiful wife in the kingdom. Now, when you look at various different commentators about this particular instance, there's a lot of disagreement over exactly how this took place. Some will say that Vashti was to be paraded around naked before all these people so they could see all of her beauty. Others say, well, we can't really know that. And the truth of the matter is, we cannot know. The Scriptures do not tell us anything beyond the fact that he was going to parade her before. For whatever reason, whether it's but looking at how he was treating everything else, it's not exactly surprising if he were to ask for his wife to parade naked. Vashti refuses. And of course, this was to be unheard of. A wife refusing the command of her husband, much less the wife of the king. And she refused, and so King Ahasuerus gets angry, and he goes through and he talks to his counselors, and his counselors are like, hey, look, if you don't deal with this woman right now, we're all going to have problems with our wives. You got to, as Barney Fife would say, you got to nip it in the bud. It's time to put a stop to this. And so they counsel him and say, all right, look, you just put her away. You banish her as queen, and that will take care of any problems that we're going to have from our wives. Really, it seems that they're looking out for their own family welfare rather than the welfare of the king. Now, as time progresses, Ahasuerus is thinking on Vashti and thinking perhaps maybe he was a little rash in getting rid of her. And those that are around him began to look and to see that he's not the same person, that he's really missing the fact of having a beautiful wife. And so they come to him and say, all right, here's the deal. Essentially, we're going to have a beauty contest throughout the land. We're going to have all the most beautiful women come, and they're going to parade before you. And you can choose one of those, and she will be made the queen. Now, as the decree is sent throughout the land, there's a man there living in the palace there in the area of Shusha by the name of Mordecai, who is cousin to a woman named Esther. And she is a very beautiful young lady. She's one of the Jews that remained there in captivity. And there she is brought in with all these other women from all across the land. And as the contest ensues, as time progresses, in the seventh year of his reign, Esther went before the king after having all these other women gone before. And everyone that met Esther loved Esther. And when it come time to go before, the women could require anything they wanted to try to appease the king. And she was just told the eunuch, she's like, well, whatever you think's best, I'll do that. And she goes before the king, and she finds favor before the king, and she becomes the queen over the Medes and the Persians. Now, over time, a man by the name of Haman, we all know this story rather well, a man by the name of Haman rose to a place of power. He rose to such a place of power that he was second in command. He was over all the other princes of the land. He rose to become just second to the king. And by the king's order, the king's servants were to bow before Haman. Now, as we can see throughout the story there, as we look at the book of Esther, we can see that Haman is an extremely proud individual. And here he is, the king is the only one above him. Everyone else has to bow down. And he's walking along, and there's this guy sitting over here at the king's at the gate, at the entrance, and he's not bowing. Not only is he not bowing, but he's not even getting up. He's not showing any kind of service to Haman. He's not even trembling in front of Haman. And so when Haman discovers that Mordecai is a Jew, he decides to take his vengeance not only on Mordecai, but on all of the Jews. In the 12th year of the reign of Ahasuerus, Haman makes his plans to destroy the Jews. If you would turn to the book of Esther there in chapter 3. Let's begin reading there in verse 8. says, Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws, so it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put into the king's treasuries. Then the king took his signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "This silver is yours, and the people also, to do with them as you please." Now as we look at these things and we see the way that these things are going, he's saying, "All right, look, I want a decree from you." And now if you go back to the time of Daniel, you remember that the princes and the satraps and all these individuals that were ruling over the land during the days of Daniel there with the Medes and the Persians, they went to the king to try to get a decree. And remember, a decree that was made by the king that had his signet ring on it could not be changed no matter what the king wanted to be done. This was what led Daniel to being thrown into the lion's den because they knew that Daniel would continue to go to his God and petition. And so he knew that if this was done, nothing whatsoever could be done to change this affair. Now, as we continue looking there, beginning in verse 13, we see where letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. Now, remember, there were 10,000 talents that were being offered as payment for those that were to do these things. That's 375 tons of silver. I don't care what time period you're living in, that's a lot of money. A car is what, 2 tons, some of them? You think of all those cars out there in the parking lot as hunks of silver, and that's just a drop in the bucket of the payment that's going to be made for those that would go out and to destroy the people. Now, once again, keep in mind that once these things have been done, there's nothing that can be done to undo it. Now, let's go back just a little bit and look at the instance there. Mordecai, when Esther first becomes king, Mordecai sits there in the king's gate and he overhears two of those that took care of the king plotting to kill the king. He tells Esther. Esther tells the king in the place of Mordecai, in the name of Mordecai, and therefore the plot is kept from occurring, and that's being put into the records. Now, when Mordecai hears the events, when this decree is being read, and it's being read a year before the day for it to happen, Mordecai hears it, and he begins to weep. He begins to wail. He begins to rip his clothes, to be in sackcloth. And not only him, but all those that are in hearing of this decree. Can you imagine? We're under some bondage somewhere, and they come in and say, "All right, all white Americans are to be put to death on the 15th of December. And there's nothing we can do to stop it." That's exactly what the Jews were facing. We look at the Jews there during the days of the 1940s and the great atrocities that were being carried out against them. This was, they were all there within the empire of the Medes and the Persians. This was going throughout the empire. And there was payment to be done to put them all to death. Now, as he hears of these things, he sends to Esther saying, "Look, you've got to intercede on our behalf." Now, if you look in chapter 4, there in verse 11, Esther replies to Mordecai. She says, "All the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king to the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to the king these 30 days." In other words, Mordecai, if I go before the king, it's pretty much certain I'm going to die. You know, you have to have a summons to go before him. He hasn't wanted to see me in 30 days. You're wanting me to go? You look in verse 13, we see Mordecai's reply. He says to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish, and who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." In other words, Esther, I know you're queen of the Medes and the Persians, but don't forget, you're a Jew. And when they go out with these 10,000 talents of silver to kill all the Jews, do you really think they're going to stop when they come to the queen? Your neck is on the line too. And not only that, he firmly believed that deliverance would be given to the people of Israel. This really shows the faith of Mordecai. Here he is in the midst of this heathen nation. Here he is, death is certain on every hand, and yet he still believes God will deliver them. Now as he sends that reply to Esther, Esther sends back a reply there in verse 16. She says, "Go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens also will fast in the same way, and thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish." In other words, if I die, well, according to you, I'm going to die anyway, so it's not really any great loss for me to go in before the king. Now we know as the story continues on, she goes, she gets all dressed up in her royal attire. She steps before the king, and there's no decree for her to be put to death. He extends the golden scepter and tells her, "Hey, I can see that there's something wrong with you. I can see there's something troubling you. Ask whatever you will, even up to half of my kingdom, I'll give it to you." It's always amazed me as we look throughout history, throughout the Bible, they're always willing to give up everything up to half of their kingdom. Women really understand the control they have over men. And so he says, "I'll give you anything." And so Esther says, "Well, here's what I would like. I want to give a banquet for you and Haman to attend today." Now, remember, Haman was there to kill the Jews. Haman had a great desire to put to death all of the Jews. But this was a great honor. And remember, Haman's a very proud individual to be the only one invited to this banquet besides the king. Just the king and the queen and him. Just imagine, Nathan, you're over there in England and you get this letter saying, "The Queen of England would like to have tea with you." That would be a great honor, would it not? Yeah, remember, keep your pinky up. It would be a great honor to be there. Even though she's not queen of our nation, there's a lot of history surrounding her. And it would be a great honor to be there. And I know he would be posting on Facebook. He would be calling, "I get to have tea with the queen. Ha ha ha, look at me." And that's really the way Haman was. "I'm going and I'm having this dinner, this banquet with the king and with the queen." At that banquet, the king asked her once again, "Look, anything you ask, I'll give it to you up to half of my kingdom." And she says, "I want to prepare another banquet tomorrow, and I want you and Haman to attend that banquet as well." Well, as this goes on, Haman's leaving proudly. He's got this smug look on his face. "I've just had dinner with the king and the queen, and they've invited me for a return engagement tomorrow. How cool am I?" And then he saw Mordecai sitting there at the king's gate. This man who would not bow down to him, that would not show him any kind of understanding of the importance of Haman. And that smug look just got, just like that, dropped off his face. And he goes home and he gathers together all of his friends and he gathers together all of his family. And if you look there in chapter 5, let's begin there in verse 11. And Haman begins to talk about how great Haman is. He says in verse 11, "Then Haman recounted to them the glory of his riches and the number of his sons, and every instance where the king had magnified him, and how he had promoted him above the princes and servants of the king. Haman also said, 'Even Esther the queen, let no one but me come with the king to the banquet which she had prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her with the king.' Yet all this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Here Haman says, "Look at how great I am. Look at how much I've got. Look at all the wonderful things that have happened to me. And it's nothing because I have to look at that Mordecai there all the time." And so his wife Zeresh says, "All right, here's what you do. You go and you build a gallows 50 cubits high." That's 75 feet high. That's a tall gallows. "And then you go into the king tomorrow and you request the right to be able to put Haman to death on those gallows." Well, about the time those things are occurring and he's talking to his wife, the time has come for him to go back and he goes. And as these things are occurring, that night, the king can't sleep. Now, we're not told why he can't sleep, but He did what probably any of us would do. He got the most boring thing he could have read to him. He had the book of the records and the chronicles of the kings of Persia to be brought and to be read to him. And as they were reading, so-and-so did such-and-such for so-and-so, and so on and so forth, all of a sudden they read, Mordecai foiled a plot to have the king put to death. And he asked his servants, he said, hey, has any honor been done to this individual? And they looked, no, nothing has been done for him. So that morning he's there trying to figure out, what should I do? And Haman's coming, all right, I'm going to go ask the king if I can have Mordecai put to death on my gallows I've been all night building. And the king is there. He's like, is anybody in the court? And they said, well, Haman's in the court. He said, well, bring Haman on in. Haman walks in. He's all ready. He's got it all figured out. His wife explained it to him. He figured it all out. This is what I'm going to do. And the king says, what kind of honor do you think the king should bestow on someone who is deserving of the king's honor? And Haman, of course, his first thought is, well, who else is the king going to honor than me? I mean, I'm the best there is in the kingdom. I'm the highest. I'm the mightiest. And so as we read there in chapter 6, beginning in verse 7, Haman thinks to himself these things. And then it says in verse 7, for the man whom the king desires to honor, let them bring a royal robe which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. And let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes. And let them array the man whom the king desires to honor and lead him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Haman's sitting there thinking, well, what would I want? Well, I want something that the king has worn. I want a horse that he has ridden on. These would be things of great value. I want these things. And so this is what I'm going to ask for. And then the king says, all right, Haman, go do that for Mordecai. Can you imagine? He already hates the man so much he's wanted to kill not just Mordecai, but all the Jews throughout the Persian Empire. And then the king says, all right, here's a robe I just wore. Here's a horse I've ridden on. Here's a crown that has been on my head. You go and you put this on the head of Mordecai. You put the robe around him. You put him on the horse. And then you parade him through the streets of the capital saying, this is what the king will do for someone whom the king wants to honor. Can you imagine having to do that? He woke up that morning thinking, this is great. I've built this gallows. I get to put to death this individual that's just really been irritating. We're not that far away from the time when all the people are going to rise up and destroy all these horrible Jews. And then he has to parade him through the streets saying, look at how great this guy is behind me. Look at how the king wants to honor him. He goes home deeply depressed. But he doesn't have time to really suffer too much because they come and say, all right, it's time for the banquet. And once again, he's there at the banquet with the king and with the queen. And the king once again says, all right, Esther, Queen Esther, what is your petition? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be done. Chapter 7, there in verse 2. Now let's read in chapter 7 there, beginning in verse 3, the reply of Queen Esther. Queen Esther replied, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as a petition and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance of the king. Then King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would presume to do thus? Esther said, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. The king arose in his anger from drinking wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther. Just picture this man who had just led Mordecai through the streets. His life is in ruins. He knows death is upon him. And he throws himself at the queen. Please, save my life. Have pity on me. Someone who's never had pity on anyone. Someone who's gloated so much against the Jewish people. He says he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, will he even assault the queen with me in the house? As the word went out from the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king said, "Behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king." And the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. I really expected to make it a lot further than I did. But as we look at this, it's an amazing story. And as we look at these things, it's interesting. When we look at the book of Esther, we see the providence of God time and time and time again. Just before a plot to destroy all the Jews comes up, a Jew gets put in the place of being a queen and is able to intercede on their behalf. God is there watching over them through all of these things. And interestingly enough, in the book of Esther, God is not mentioned not once. There's no petition to God. There's not even any mention of prayers or thanksgiving. Now, we do remember Esther said, "All right, you go to your house and fast, and I'll go to my house and fast." That's the closest thing we get to prayer and petitions to God there in the book of Esther. Now, as we go further on, as you can read in the remaining portions, Esther further requested a decree which would allow the Jews to defend themselves. Once again, that first decree was given out 10,000 talents to destroy all the Jews. It cannot be changed. And that's what Ahasuerus says to Esther. "I can't change it." And so she's like, "Okay, let Mordecai write a decree that will give the Jews the right to defend themselves." And so the decree is sent throughout. The Jews are given the right to gather together and to fight all those who would come against them. All those that were their enemies. All those that were taking that 10,000 talents of silver to put to death the Jews. And the people of the land of the Medes and the Persians became so afraid that many of them become proselyte Jews. "I want to make sure I'm on the right side." They understood. Even the princes of the land stood with the Jews and worked with them. And the Jews killed 75,000 of those who hated them. And nowhere in the book of Esther do we read of any Jew dying. Once again, we see the great and mighty power of God. In His time, He makes all things beautiful in His time. He keeps His Word in His time. He made the promise that when you go into captivity, a remnant will return. He made the promise that out of that remnant, He would rise up the seed of David, who would become king forever. And here a decree has gone out to kill all the Jews, and God protects them. God watches over them. As we continue looking at the kings that are to come up, we see once again, time and time again, God is watching out for those that are striving to live according to His will. I had intended to get through Nehemiah and Ezra tonight, but Lord willing, we'll look at those things next Thursday evening, and we'll look at Malachi. And next Thursday evening, we'll truly put to close the Old Testament with these final words of Malachi. And the time of the famine for the Word of God will fall upon the land. A time that will not be stopped until the Lord determines the right time. Now, as we've been looking at these things, once again, there's a lot of history in these things. And it's easy to get caught up and go, "Well, it's historical. It really doesn't have anything to do with me or with my service to God." The world has not changed since the days of Ahasuerus, Artaxerxes, Xerxes, all those individuals. There are still powers that are ruling in this world, powers that will do what they can to try to stop us from serving God. But as we can see throughout the history of the Jews, as we can see throughout the history of their captivity and the time between the Testaments, God watched over them when they served Him. God caused them to prosper when they served Him. God kept His faithful so that His prophecies could be fulfilled. Now there's been a prophecy made that those who are faithful to God will be amongst those who rise up into the heavens to meet the Lord when He returns. We read in the book of 1 Thessalonians, we read that the dead in Christ will rise first, and then we who remain will rise up to meet them in the air. Those that are faithful to God have that prophecy, that promise of being with Jesus in heaven throughout all eternity. Now, you are given this opportunity tonight to look and to ask yourself, am I faithful to God's will. As we continue looking at these things, we can see where Ezra, Nehemiah, and finally Malachi had to constantly try to turn the Jews back to God. Put away these foreign women. Don't serve these things. Follow God. Follow Him with all of your heart. Perhaps you're here and you've looked into your life and you've not been faithful in your service to God. While you may have been a child of God, you've fallen astray. You've gone back into the world. You followed in the path of the Jews before you. Today is the day. Today is the day of salvation. Don't harden your hearts as they did in the days of the rebellion. Don't turn away from the Lord. Don't say, I'll do it later. It's truly now or never. If you've never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, then today is your opportunity to confess your belief that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, to repent of your sins, and be buried in baptism. Whatever your situation might be, make it right in the sight of God as we stand and as we sing.